You're listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 9. Today, we're talking about how to help your child overcome barriers to learning. As you'll learn in this episode, barriers to learning can come in lots of different shapes and forms. They range from having specific learning difficulties like dyslexia to going through a tough time emotionally. For example, if children are being bullied, they've fallen out with friends, or there's something difficult going on at home. So please keep listening to understand how you can better help your child to overcome barriers to learning. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Sheila Mulvenny.
Hi.
Hi, it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated to dive into this conversation about barriers to learning because I know when I was teaching in schools, I taught in schools for 4 years in secondary schools, that you saw so many children that had such a wide range of barriers to learning. And, you know, it's a real, really real problem for teachers, but also for parents navigating those things and helping their children to get over them. So firstly, Sheila, can you explain to us what you actually mean by barriers to learning?
Yeah, I think a barrier to learning really is anything that happens to get in the way of learning. And I think it's often helpful to think of it as there can either be some quite general barriers. So it means almost any sort of learning is a bit of a problem at that time. Or there can be some quite specific problems, some specific barriers. And you've probably come across this. So you might find as a teacher that the child does really well, is very motivated, very able to learn in English, but actually struggles every time they walk into the room for maths. So I think it's quite helpful to split them into general barriers. So what we know is that we don't learn well if we're tired, if we're cold, if we're hungry, if our minds are full of other stuff. And they're kind of the general barriers. But then there's also some very specific barriers over maybe particular subjects or particular topics within a particular subject where for some reason at a particular time a child just really or young person that just really struggles to learn.
Yeah, definitely. So can we first maybe talk about those specific barriers to learning a little bit, and then we'll move on to the more general things, because I think that's going to be a more wide-ranging conversation. So what are the specific barriers to learning that you come across most frequently?
Well, I first became interested in this actually working with quite mature students. I was teaching people who'd already had a successful career in care or care management, and they were going for kind of management certificates. So these were people who'd, the world would say these were successful people. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered was a lot of them had a really, really low opinion of their own ability to learn. And that created quite a massive barrier because their lack of confidence in academic learning really, really meant that, you know, they would take ages to approach a task, you'd give them homework and you knew they wouldn't be doing it. And I remember vividly sitting with one, and this isn't a child, this is an adult, who, as I say, the world would see as successful, giving her back an essay that was an A, and she was absolutely convinced that this must have been somebody else's, her opinion. Her own ability to actually write what she knew she knew. So I think one of the really specific barriers to learning is a person's own opinion about their ability to learn in that particular topic.
So that's kind of what I call self-belief and mindset.
Absolutely.
So in your experience, what is it that sets people back in terms of their mindset and self-belief?
Well, I think sometimes it's experience, past experience. I mean, if I go back to those mature learners, and then I'll kind of, you know, roll it a bit, but for younger folk, I think they'd had a lot of poor experiences where they hadn't seen themselves as successful in an academic way. Now, schools are, you know, we do have a kind of one size fits all within schools. And I think sadly, you know, there are young people where they don't get the best experiences at school. They feel they're not doing well. They feel they can't manage that or they can't do that. And I think the actual learning then becomes almost not as important as what it's doing to them, because you do get some children, I think, who leave school and their opinion of their own ability to learn is what will hold them back, rather than actual ability to learn. So I think that can be simply just not managing in the subject, not being helped when they needed help. And a strand that goes through that, I think, although it's slightly, you know, to the side, is people that struggle with literacy. Because, of course, if you struggle with reading, you will struggle in every single subject that anybody ever puts in front of you. And I think as an education system, we've not always been very good at identifying those children early and giving them the kind of help that they need.
Definitely. And it's in my work, it's the children who I see struggling most with exams are those who haven't really worked on their literacy skills. So when they read an exam question, their comprehension isn't good enough to really understand what the question is asking them to do. And then I see particularly young men who are doing GCSEs and A-levels who can't write well enough. Their handwriting isn't good enough to write in exams. And it's a real, real problem because they may know their stuff, but they can't get what they know onto a piece of paper simply because their handwriting isn't good enough. Absolutely. And, you know, actually investing time and energy into getting those things right are going to make the biggest difference in the long term, aren't they?
They are. And I think in foundational terms, I mean, I one of my side things that I do is I am a phonics trainer. Mm-hmm. And I know that people have lots of different views about phonics. But I always say to primary school teachers, if a child hasn't learned to read effectively by the time they leave primary school, nobody is ever going to teach them again because they don't know how to teach them to read. It's a particular set of skills to teach a person to read. And if they don't get it first time round, we offer lots of support, but nobody actually goes back to the beginning and teaches them how to read. And I think things like writing very much spring from their ability to read. In fact, things like vocabulary, after the age of 7, most new words that you learn through reading, not through speaking. Because, of course, we have a very rich vocabulary, but we only use a tiny percentage of it in our day-to-day conversations. But we use much more of it in literature. So if a child can't read, it starts to have, you know, absolutely major knock-on effects. But that's, you know, that is one particular barrier to learning, I suppose.
Yeah, so I just wanted to come back to kind of this mindset thing as well, because I've been chatting to some of the parents at my children's school recently and really understanding how important a child's relationship with their teachers is in building kind of self-esteem and a positive attitude towards learning. Is that something that you see in your work?
Absolutely. And in fact, as I say, just going back to those older learners, which I'm talking 20 years ago now, but going back to those, I was shocked by the fact that often they would come out with things that had been said to them as a child at school. Teachers, like or not, and I've been teaching for years, that there is tremendous power. Children look up to you, and the things that teachers say can really lodge in a child's brain. And it might just be a throwaway comment. They might not be intending to, you know, say something quite critical to a child, but a child just kind of soaks it up. And I think for parents, the most important thing you can do there is to have like a really open dialogue so children can tell you if anything's been said and you can counter it if you need to. Obviously, you might then have a discussion with the teacher, but the important thing is to counter if they've dropped in something that is saying, you know, oh, I think you're always going to find this difficult. Actually, you're finding it difficult now. That doesn't mean you're going to find it difficult in the future, you know.
Yeah, that's all about having a growth mindset, isn't
Absolutely.
It? But that's a whole different conversation. So
it certainly is not going
to, I've got a blog post about that and I'll link to it in the show notes. So I wanted to ask on the back of that, just raise a point really, because when I was teaching in schools, you could kind of tell that there were some parents who had a very respectful and positive attitude towards teachers, and other parents who probably had a bad experience of school and teachers themselves, and they were kind of passing along that attitude to their children. So what do you think that parents can do to foster that positive relationship between both the parents and the teachers and the children and the teachers, so it's a really good kind of three-way working relationship?
I mean, I think the first step is the parent has to be really honest with themselves. That I would say a child is always going to struggle in a school if a parent really lacks confidence. I think the child, you know, the parent has to be honest. If they really don't think that school or that teacher is working, they need to take some action, because I think the drip feed of negativity that the child will pick up, even if the parent is wise enough not to say the words, you can tell by the shrug of the eyes, the hunch of the shoulders, and children are very good at picking that up, that the parent doesn't respect the teacher. And I think that's something as schools that they can almost, you know, I think we can get better at addressing that right at the beginning of a child's career in a school, that, you know, establishing that we want to work as partners, we want to work together. If ever there's a problem, come and talk to us. But the point you made at the beginning is really important, because of course everyone has an experience of school. whether it's good, bad or indifferent, they've got an experience of it. Whereas lots of other places in life, you go to people and they're the experts because you haven't experienced that. Whereas, of course, everyone kind of thinks they're an expert on school because they've been to school.
Yeah, so like it's really hard, I think, for parents to kind of leave behind that personal experience they've had in their formative years and come to it with a fresh pair of eyes. And with a lot of the parents that I work with now, a lot of them feel kind of at sea a bit because education appears to have changed a lot with all the changes with recent governments and everything. And they don't really know how to, well, they don't understand what's going on really in schools anymore. And I think that makes it really challenging for them and really decreases their confidence in terms of interacting with the school. How do you think parents can overcome that?
Well, I think parents can do some of the overcoming by determining themselves to find out about some of the changes. Having said that, I think some of the changes, particularly over the whole Progress 8 and GCSEs, are actually quite difficult to get your head around as, as a parent. But I think schools have a part to play, and I think schools are a lot better at engaging parents and telling them what's going to be coming up on the schemes of work, explaining where to go and get information about why they are doing things, why they're covering particular subjects or why they're doing it in a particular way. And if I go back to something like phonics, for example, most parents will not have been taught to read using phonics. No. So it really is like a foreign language for them. But I know a lot of schools will run kind of a work workshops of parents, give them leaflets, so at least they can feel like they can understand what the child is doing, because they could be doing a lot of help and a lot of support at home, but actually they could also be kind of working against it if they don't understand the way things are being taught and the reasons why they're being taught that way. So I think it is about a dialogue between the parents and the teachers. Having said that, I think you can only really have that very fruitful dialogue if parents are kind of prepared to accept either that their experience in school won't be the same as their child's, and that what worked for them won't necessarily work for their child. Because I think, you know, parents, we can be very, oh well, this was brilliant, this is what I did, and this was, and I got this, and actually that worked then for you at that time, but that might not be the thing that works for your child at this point.
And that's something I'm really keen to emphasize with both parents and teachers, is almost empowering students to make their own choices about how to learn, informed choices about how to learn and, you know, what's best for them. I remember one parent in my Facebook group recently, well, during the last exam season, saying, this worked really, really well for me, but it just doesn't seem to work for my child, but I don't know what to suggest as an alternative. And, you know, it is about letting go of those things that work for you and were true back in the day, maybe, but aren't anymore.
And I think also that being prepared to try different things. I mean, one of the wonderful things you mentioned, your Facebook group, is, you know, you can often ask other parents, you know, what did you do? Because I'm really struggling with this with my child. And obviously ask the child. You know, children are often, sometimes I think we sort of can very easily cut them out of the conversation. But often children do know the ways that they learn best or an approach that might work for them. Although I remember my daughter saying to me, she's grown up now, that, you know, it's great because they take all this effort to, you know, identify what learning style you have, but actually exams are just one learning style. You get asked a question and you have to write the answer, and that is it, isn't it? Doesn't matter, you know, if you're best at explaining your answers or doing it while you're moving around, none of those count really, do they?
Well, I think the way it's examined is one kind of assessment style, but actually there's different ways to learn the material.
Absolutely.
If parents are interested in that, there's I give away a free chapter of my book, which is all about helping your child to discover how they like to learn, on my website, and you can get that at livemoreextraordinary.com/free-chapter, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. So we've been talking a lot about specific barriers to learning, but I think the area we haven't really covered is actual diagnosed learning difficulties. So could you talk to us a bit more about that, Sheila?
Yeah, I mean, I think in any school, there are, in any classroom, there will be children that have very specific difficulties to learning, difficulties with their learning. And there could be things like dyslexia, dyscalculia, those sorts of things. There can also be, much more specific special educational needs, which might change the approach to learning. And the important thing is just because someone faces a challenge with their learning doesn't mean they're not able to learn and doesn't mean they're not able to get there in the long run. It just means that the learning often has to be kind of packaged in a slightly different way so it's accessible to them. And that's kind of what learning styles are all about. But when you can add in those children that have specific learning needs, then that becomes so much more essential, really, to make sure that they can access the curriculum. I mean, I know it does sadden me sometimes when I think you have an awful lot of children sat in an awful lot of classrooms that actually the learning has been presented, but they might not be learning. And so I think they need that making of things to be accessible. And I think, one of the things that if we talk about children with emotional problems sort of thing, but I always say, it's very evident if a child has a plaster on their leg that they need help to get up the stairs. If a child has, say, dyslexia or has another kind of issue, it's not as apparent the kind of scaffolding and help they would need to get to that place where they can learn.
So what can parents do again with these specific learning needs to kind of overcome these barriers to learning? Like in a general sense, we can't go into each one of them individually right now, but what kind of attitude and steps can they take?
I mean, I think the first thing is to acknowledge it. I think parents often know way before anybody else that there's a problem. And somehow, as parents, we think, oh, maybe I'm being neurotic. Maybe I'm, looking for things when they're not there. But I think all the research seems to show that the earlier you can identify something and get help for the child, the better. So even over, if we take something very simple like literacy, if they're not getting there with their reading, that you have two approaches. One is you leave it. And you go on and you see what happens, and that might be appropriate in a tiny few cases. Or the other is you start doing something. Now, I think when it comes to things like interventions, you have to be quite careful because you really need to know what the problem is to know how to intervene. Now, that's relatively simple when it comes to reading. If it's more of a global issue and it's every aspect of learning, then that's slightly more complicated. But I think identifying it early, go to talk to the school. If the school also think there's a problem, then deciding together, what kind of would the next step be? Was does there need to be an investigation? Do they need to have an assessment by a clinician or something like that? But I think not letting it ride. I think parents, we don't like to appear like we're being neurotic and overprecious, but actually, lots and lots of problems are not such big problems if they're dealt with early on.
And so it's all about firstly going with your intuition and secondly having that dialogue, that conversation with the school, really, to kind of help you move through that difficulty. Okay, so we've talked very much about the specific learning difficulties or the specific barriers to learning there. What about the more general barriers to learning that you come across? What are they, first of all?
Well, I think a barrier to learning, I say, is anything that stops a child learning. I think if we're talking general things, we've probably all had occasions where we've gone to work, but our head has been so full of stuff because we're worried about a friend or a partner or whatever, or even just that our car's broken down and we have to be in the garage, all sorts of things that actually becomes quite hard to concentrate and quite hard to actually take on board learning. So I think, if children are upset or worried or anxious about anything, and that could be in the school or in the home. So if they're worried about break time because there is an issue with bullying, then they might not be in a good place to learn. Or if they're worried because they heard their mum and dad arguing last night, which is a normal part of life, but maybe it had happened a few times and the child's kind of overthinking it and worrying a bit, then actually that might well stop them learning. And I think when it comes to those general things, it's important to realise that it might just be for a short period of time or just a few hours that a child's not able to learn. But actually, obviously, the more worrying one is when it's something that goes on for quite a long period of time. So obviously a child where maybe there is problems in the home, maybe a parent's out of work and they're worried about money, maybe parents are arguing or they're splitting up, maybe there's a house move coming, maybe there's an older sibling that is evident they're having problems. Those sort of things I think are harder to deal with, and I think parents can deal with them and manage them well, but I think it takes a little bit more skill.
So what can parents do when they can see some of these like major things that we all know cause problems for children in terms of accessing their learning. So, for instance, parents splitting up or moving house or breakdown in friendships at school. What can parents actually do to anticipate and kind of mitigate or make those problems smaller and have less of an impact on a child's education?
Well, I think the most important thing is being there. And that means not just being kind of physically available, although that's important because I think children are very quick to pick up if you're busy. And often children don't want to bother parents and things like that. But so making sure that you're available in every sense of the word, making sure that you give the chance and the permission for the child to talk. They have to know it's okay to have problems. They have to know if they have a problem, they can talk to you. If you sense that something's wrong, then I think you have to also give them the, depending on the age of the child, the kind of the vocabulary and the script almost to talk about it. So obviously with a lot of children, if you say, oh, how's things? You seem quiet lately. They're, oh, it's fine. So it's almost like creating the next step on to say, you know, sometimes people at school find they're not very happy if you think it's a school-based issue. Mm-hmm. If it's something to do with home, I think the worst thing you can do is kind of pretend it's not happening. So if, say, there is a problem in a relationship or a problem with an older sibling or something like that, I think you have to say, you know, I know things are tough like right now, or you might have heard us arguing last night or whatever, and then give them some you know, insecurity is the worst thing for children. So be honest with them about what might be happening. So, you know, even if there is a situation where, say, parents are breaking up, you know, we might not be going to live together in the future, but we will both still love you. And so give them, you know, the what nearly always what a child imagines is worse than what's going to happen unless it's something really, really terrible. So we're far better to be honest with them. And I think often as parents, we try to protect them by not being honest, but that's often the worst thing we can do. Having said that, I think that the other side of that coin is that life does have to go on. So I think you can be nurturing, you can be supportive, but there comes a point where actually, even as a parent who's suffering a lot of stress, often you do still get up and go to work. And so children often still need to have, you know, a lot of nurture, a lot of support, but also a little bit of firmness that says, you know, actually the thing that's going to help us is kind of keeping going with a lot of things, keeping learning. That's going to be good. Having those times that are fun. But I think the most important thing is having that kind of dialogue so the child feels it's okay to tell you how they feel.
Yeah, because a lot of the time in times of uncertainty, particularly at home, school is the thing that gives the structure and the foundation and, you know, Absolutely. All those things that children really thrive with. So making sure they continue to access education and kind of normality can be really, Yes. really helpful.
Yes, I think it's often helpful to give the school a bit of a heads up. You know, you don't need to share your life with the school, but I think it is important to say, oh, you know, so-and-so's dad's working away a lot now, if that's the case, or we're thinking we might be moving away, or their grandmother's ill. Or I think it's good to give them a bit of a heads up, because then the school just know that they can have a dialogue as well. And sometimes children might be more honest with the teacher than with the parent at that point, because they might not want to worry the parent.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, as a teacher, I often had children come to me with worries and concerns about what was going on at home because they didn't feel able to bring it up at home. So, yeah, teachers have a very strong role there. But again, I think it's about that three-way conversation between the student, the Absolutely. Teacher and the parent.
Yeah. I think it is. And I think that is where a good teacher-parent relationship, but as I say, I mentioned before, I think a parent really has to have confidence in the school, because that's when you get the best relationship. If you're constantly feeling the school is going to handle it wrong, then at these times as well, that's just another area of insecurity. So it's good to, if you're feeling that, to go and have a discussion with the teacher, sort out whatever the issues are, and feel that you can both work together to support the child.
Yeah, definitely. How can parents increase the empathy and compassion of their children for other young people who are experiencing emotional upheaval that may disrupt their learning? So I know when I was at school, I saw a lot of really bad behaviour from other students in my classes that were, it was really disruptive and really slowed down my learning. And I really resented it and hated it. And Yes. I saw the same thing happening when I was a teacher. And at that point in time, I had more information, not hugely detailed information about students who weren't under my pastoral care, but I had more information about why they were showing the disruptive behaviour they were showing. But how can you inculcate in children this kind of empathy and understanding of why some children might find it more difficult to settle to learning and why they might be disrupting the members, other members of the class?
I think I think it is quite a hard one because I think as parents, we always want to protect our children. But actually, you know, there are lots of situations in the world and lots of children are living through lots of situations that are just way short of ideal. I think things like books and stories can be a really, really a good way of doing it. And in fact, I've got a book to be published soon, which to go with my other book, which is very much about a child who has huge problems, who meets a child who hasn't, and the kind of relationship that they develop. Because I think, why should children who are in loving, happy homes with parents that are supporting them, they would have no understanding of the fact that that's not the life for every child. So I think the way you can do it is the kind of an understanding that not everybody's life is the same, and you wouldn't necessarily know what other people are struggling with. But the other thing, I think the strand that goes with that is that the notion that we choose behaviour. I think there are elements where everybody chooses behaviour, but there's also elements where we're driven to behave in a particular way. So one of the examples I often give is that, you know, as adults, if you've had a really bad day at work, you don't intend to go home and take it out on the family. You don't think in the car, right, I'm going to give my partner a really hard time when I walk through the door because I've had an awful day. But often what happens is you give them a really hard time when they walk through the door over something incidental because they've left the boots on the carpet or they've put mud somewhere. And I think that whole, you know, we didn't make that decision to behave in that way, but because of what we were feeling, that's what happened. And I think an understanding that sometimes children in class behave in a particular way, and we might not always know why, but there will always be a reason. There will be a driver. There will be something going on that's making them behave in that particular way. And but so I think books, I think having that open dialogue and that sense that there's always two sides to every story. But having said that, it's also putting in that, you know, yes, it's good to be empathetic. It's good for them to understand what might be going on with other children in the class. But also they do have a right to an undisrupted education. And as a parent, I think you can do both of those things. You can acknowledge that not every child will be in the same place to learn as maybe your own child. But also from the school's point of view, they need to manage that. So it isn't disrupting the learning of others in the way, obviously, there was a time when your learning was disrupted.
Yeah. And it was, you know, I remember my own parents going into school with a couple of other parents, like time after time after time, to try and sort these problems out. And they never really did resolve. And I ended up leaving that school and going to a different school for my sixth form. But it's really hard, I think, particularly when you've got hardworking, ambitious students, to recognise what's going on for those other children. And having that level of empathy and compassion, and but also still wanting to drive on with your own studies and be successful. So that it's a really delicate area, I think, to understand. And
I think it's tough to get that kind of middle ground. And I think sadly as well with schools, you know, some schools have an awful lot of children that we could describe as vulnerable. That, you know, in every single class, I would pretty much say that there will be some children that are struggling with all sorts of stuff that you wouldn't.
Yeah, and several children.
And then in some classes, there might be, that might almost be the majority in some schools.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, and I think, as I say, it's this balance of, you know, our children need to understand that while life might be rosy for them, and as a parent, that's what you want to make it. You want to make it as good as it can be. You know, there are some children, sadly, who that isn't the case. You know, they might be looking after a mother before they come to work. They might not have clean clothes to wear. They might not have food. You know, and that stuff is still going on in our society today, sort of thing. And I think we all find that quite slightly hard to comprehend. So, you know, one of our responses to that is to kind of brush it a bit under the carpet and think, oh no, they're just, you know, they're just being a bit naughty, they're just not behaving. And I'm sure there's some that are, you know, there are some that quite definitely will make choices about what to do but and how they disrupt other people, because often for them that might be to get out of a situation that they're afraid they're going to fail in because of their own kind of barriers to learning. But you know, it's this kind of balance of being empathetic, making sure that those children get the help they need, but that also those children who do want to learn are actually able to learn. And that's a tough one for schools, given that often, you know, there's funding cuts and there's not enough bodies and things like that. It's a quite a hard job to manage, really, but it is about meeting the needs of every child, and children should have the ability to learn and be put in a situation where they can learn.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, moving on a bit. I know you're a bit of an expert on emotional freedom technique, or as it's known, EFT, and I'm really interested in how it can help young people who are experiencing barriers to learning.
Yeah.
Maybe you explain a little about what it is first. I'm familiar with it, but I'm sure many of the listeners won't be.
No. So emotional freedom technique, it's kind of a bit of a it came about with a background that comes from neuro-linguistic programming, which is very much about how our thoughts shape our feelings and what we do, and how often we're not aware of some of those, there's often quite subconscious thoughts, and that feeds into mindset. And also ancient kind of Chinese medicine in terms of using acupressure points. So it's quite basically you tap with yourself with your own fingers on acupressure points whilst you're stating certain affirmations about either what your problem is to get rid of it or what you want the future to be. So the reason I became interested in it was working with some of these children who, in fact, had experienced all sorts of quite horrible things, really. And often the only thing they'd be offered would be some sort of therapy in inverted commas, something like psychotherapy. And often that involves the child having to almost relive whatever's happened in order to get to a place where they can deal with it. So I sort of discovered emotional freedom technique, and what I loved about it is the person learns to do it themselves. So it's kind of quite an empowering tool. And I know a lot of people have used it to manage anxiety. And you can just go on the internet and learn how to do it and do it for yourself. So, it can be used as a very much a kind of therapeutic tool, but I use it, I suppose, mostly as a tool for kind of developing positive mindsets and motivation, really. So I think when there's a barrier to learning, the first thing that they need to do is acknowledge. So in a round of tapping, you would just do that. Even though I'm finding this maths really tough and I feel like I'm useless and I can't do it, and do a round of tapping on that through to that, actually, it would be there is a part of me that knows I can do it. Yeah. And I can be successful in this, and kind of shifting that mindset. And almost always I find it has a difference. With children, I've used it with children where they've got quite big problems. It's not necessarily getting rid of their problem, but it's giving them a strategy to use so they can kind of get on with their day or overcome whatever the anxiety and the problem is at that time.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I've heard a lot about it in the kind of entrepreneurial world, and mindset's really important there in terms of making a business thrive. And people often have very negative thoughts about, I'm not good enough, I don't deserve this, or money, money's dirty, or whatever. And you can start to reprogram those thoughts using techniques like EFT. And I think it's the same, I see the same kind of mindset struggles and challenges with children approaching their exams where they're
Absolutely.
saying all these negative things to themselves, and if they can begin to reprogram that, then that's really positive. So I personally, I've used videos on YouTube to kind of understand more about what EFT is. So I'll find one of those and link to that in the show notes so that people, if they're interested, can find out more.
Yes, I think I've got one short one on my website somewhere. I think it's at the articles. What is it? EFT tapping, and I think it just shows you quite simply what it is. But I think what I love about it is it's empowering. You're not having to go to an expert for it. It's something you can learn to do yourself, which I think, in terms of, say, children and exam anxiety, or like you say, their mindset around exams. Actually, it's brilliant, isn't it? Because they can get on and do it whenever they need it.
Just like pop to the loo before they go into an exam and do a
Absolutely.
quick round of tapping.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. Is there anything else that you think parents should know before we finish off about reducing their children's barriers to learning and how to manage that?
No, I mean, I think the overriding thing for me is that I think learning is vitally important, and I think we usually want our children to fulfill their potential. But actually, I think the overriding thing, even more important for that, we want them to feel happy and be and know that they'll be loved. And I think it's quite a hard balance as a parent, having, I've had three children of my own who are all grown up, and I'm now a grandmother. And it's like, you're so intensely wanting them to do well, that sometimes we can slip into unintentionally putting those kind of negative things that they might not realize for years later, that somehow their doing well is tied up with their self-esteem. And actually, the most important thing is, they are of value, and as parents, you will love them whatever. And that actually, that doesn't work against learning. That gives them that really solid foundation that actually it's okay to try, it's okay to fail, because there's still a safe base. And actually, that's what frees people up usually to feel like they're able to learn. One of the most common barriers to learning really is being afraid to fail. and creating that mindset where actually, you know, if you think about a child learning to walk, they would, if they didn't walk till they could do it perfectly and not fall on the bottom, no child would ever walk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's part of the learning process, isn't it? Is to fall over a bit and, you know, have someone there to pick you up and on you go, sort of thing.
Definitely. But there's something about formal education, particularly in the exam years, which like paralyzes people with this fear of failure. So they almost stop trying. And so they make failure more likely. And actually, I've got another blog post about that, about fear of failure. So I'll link to that in the show notes as well. Yeah, so it's been really interesting, Sheila. Where, if parents want to know more about your work, can they find you online?
There's my website, Attuned Education. In fact, I have two. One is very much education based for children and parents, but I also have an entrepreneurial one, Attuned Success, which is very much around supporting entrepreneurs and people who are starting businesses. So Attuned Education and Attuned Success.
Okay, and I'll link to that in the show notes. And I love that name, Attuned, because it really kind of speaks to what you've just said to us in that last section about, you know, really being in tune with your child and their emotions and helping them to develop that strong foundation from which success will spring. So a really good choice of name there.
Well, it did come up from, attuned is a word we use in attachment theory. And of course, a lot of the children that I've worked with in terms of children in care, you know, one of their big problems is they didn't get a good attachment to an adult. And so no one was actually attuned to what they needed. So I like the idea of attuned, you know, that the whole point is, you know, as parents, we want to be attuned to their education. And as schools, we want to give them the education that they need in their particular way, sort of thing.
Fantastic. And I know you've got a book as well. What's that called, Sheila?
The book is called Overcoming Barriers to Learning. It is very much about the children I've worked with, as I say, children with quite severe sort of emotional and social sort of problems, really, and mental health problems. But it's Overcoming Barriers to Learning, and it's very much geared at schools. You know, what can you do when a child's not in a place to learn? And the whole thought is that actually I'm not saying teachers can be mental health experts, because they can't, but actually sometimes all they need is a little bit of permission. And part of this is often getting them out of the class for a while, so someone can do something good with them that will get them back into the class as quickly as possible and be able to learn. And that's about making sure that the other children in the class can continue learning as well.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen that over and over again in classrooms. And then you're also on Facebook and on Twitter, and I will put all the links to the website, book and the social media in the show notes, so people can check those out and come and find you if they would like to talk to you.
Yes, absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, Sheila. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was brilliant. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you found that both interesting and helpful. If you've got any questions or comments, please leave them in the show notes, which you'll find at livemoreextraordinary.com/9. You'll also be able to check out all the links and resources Sheila and I mentioned in the episode from there. Also, you could come and leave comments or questions in my Facebook group that's specifically for parents, which is called the Supportive Parents Successful Students Facebook group. You can just search for that in Facebook, or there's a link to it in the show notes. Or you can always send me a tweet at Lucy C. Parsons. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to it in your podcast app and leave a review. Every review helps to spread the word to more people who will find the show both interesting and helpful. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.